You're listening to CNAS Live, our on-the-go audio version of recent events hosted by the Center for a New American Security. Nationwide, there has been a noticeable uptick in swatting cases. Swatting is the act of making a prank call to emergency services in an attempt to trick police into sending a heavily armed raid to someone's address, often a SWAT team. These acts have seen a recent increase in their use against politicians and public servants. In this episode of our Safe at Home speaker series, CNAS hosted a virtual event with Kenneth Corey, former NYPD Chief of Department, and Josh Campbell, CNAS Adjunct Senior Fellow and CNN Correspondent. The event was moderated by CNAS Senior Fellow Carrie Cordero. They discussed the increase of these incidents, challenges to law enforcement agencies in terms of resources, capacity, and risk, and proposed legislative remedies at the state and federal levels. CNAS Safe at Home speaker series aims to inform policymakers, the media, and the public to ensure that domestic security and public safety are adequately represented in national security conversations and problem-solving efforts. Learn more at cnas.org/safe-home. Here's their conversation.
Good morning and welcome to the Safe at Home series hosted by the Center for a New American Security. I'm Carrie Cordero, and the Safe at Home series is a component of our Securing U.S. Democracy initiative at the Center for a New American Security. The goal of it is to provide a venue in the national security policy community to talk about issues that are of homeland security and public safety all across the country, and bring greater attention to those issues that affect Americans on a daily basis in their communities. As democracy is under strain in many parts of the world, including sometimes here at home, it's important that we regularly feature the ways how democracy delivers for people in their daily lives. And one of those aspects is a reasonable degree of public safety and security at home. So in this series, which we have conducted over time, we talk about various issues of homeland security, domestic terrorism, political violence, cybersecurity, emergency response and preparedness. And we feature leaders who are both in government and out of government this year, with a particular focus on issues at the state and local level, and communicating with individuals and featuring voices that are folks who are out in the country trying to solve these problems at the state and local level. Just a note for our viewers, this conversation is taking place live and being live streamed on CNAS's website and social media channels. We also will have the archive of the video posted on the CNAS website that you can return to, and also the audio of this session will be featured in CNAS's podcast, which is CNAS Live, and you can find that wherever you find your podcasts. Today's conversation, and I'm really glad that you are joining us, we are talking about the issue of swatting and the challenges that it is currently presenting for law enforcement agencies all around the country. And there is a particular threat lately focused on public officials. This is a bipartisan issue. Public officials across both parties, from elected leaders to judges and prosecutors to individuals who are public servants working in the election infrastructure, have all been targeted by this issue of swatting. And I'm joined by two terrific experts on this issue, Josh Campbell and Ken Corey, who are going to join us for this conversation. I want to just give our viewers a little bit of a background of Josh and Ken's experience and why I reached out to them to talk with us on this issue. Josh is also my colleague at CNN, where he is a correspondent focused on national security and homeland security and law enforcement and public safety issues. He is also an adjunct senior fellow here with us at CNAS. And he has deployed all over the country covering some of the most critical public safety events all around the country. He also has a law enforcement background himself as a former FBI agent, where He deployed all around the country working on counterterrorism and major law enforcement cases, as well as internationally. He also is a military reserve officer, which also brings him even closer to our CNAS community in particular with its substantial military and defense experience. I also want to welcome Ken Corey, who retired a little bit over a year ago from the New York City Police Department after 34 years of service with the NYPD. Ken has extensive experience in law enforcement throughout that 34-year record of service. He was most recently the chief of department, which gave him leadership over all of the operational activity of the NYPD, up and down in terms of all the activities they do. In particular, he worked to plan and direct police operations at major events like Madison Square Garden and Yankee Stadium and the U.S. Open, the U.N. General Assembly, so major national and international events that are hosted there in New York. And so he has a wide range of on-the-ground experience. He currently is working at a police leadership institute at the University of Chicago Crime Lab as one of his post-NYPD activities. And he also serves as a strategic advisor to the Secure Community Network. If you didn't catch our conversation with the head of Secure Community Network, we hosted Michael Masters in our December edition of the Safe at Home series, where we focused a conversation on anti-Semitism and countering that violence all over the country. So you're welcome to go back and take a look at that conversation. Ken and Josh, thank you so much for joining us today and for lending us your expertise on this issue. Josh, let me start out with you, because I know that in your reporting with CNN, you have observed and covered some of these swatting incidents all over the country. So can you just kind of start us out and give us an overview of, what's new about what is going on maybe in the last year or two in terms of the depth and breadth of the swatting incidents around the country?
Sure, Carrie. And first, thanks to CNAS and yourself for covering this very critical topic. This is a growing public safety threat. We continue to hear that from law enforcement, from elected leaders, as you mentioned, from election workers. And as we'll discuss today, this is only going to get worse if more isn't done. Now, just to say at the outset, when we talk about swatting, prank calls and fake threats are as old as telecommunication itself. I mean, we're all used to, the old the bomb threats, right? Called into a school when the kid didn't want to take a test, or other mischief makers, causing disruption. The difference here now is that we're seeing through swatting, and we'll get into what that is specifically, but the relative anonymity of the internet is affording bad actors the ability to cause great harm with that anonymity. And we've seen that, this is not a joke. These pranks that we've seen, some of the threats, these have actually led to death and injury. You can only imagine, when we talk about swatting, that's essentially someone who is calling in a threat to police about a violent crime that is in progress or that is about to happen. We often hear about someone calling in, an active shooter at a particular location. And you can only imagine what that does, the officer surging to that location, they're amped up, they're being told that there was an active threat that they are being called upon to stop. And when they arrive at the scene, you have people who have no idea what's happening at a particular location, because obviously they're not the ones who actually called 911. That is a potentially deadly combination there, where you have officers that are amped up, rolling up on people who are unsuspecting, about what is even occurring. Now, to your point about what we've seen in recent months and in the last couple of years, is that there's essentially been a shift in what law enforcement is seeing as far as motivations. Now, swatting is not new. It's been on law enforcement's radar for over two decades. We think about, celebrities like Ashton Kutcher and others who were, the victims of swatting. That's really when it started, picking up public notoriety. And again, that was mischief making. People doing it for, as the FBI described, quote, bragging rights, when they're particularly online gaming groups saying, let's go do this thing. And then, whoever's successful at it, props to you. law enforcement has seen a shift in motivation. Now people using swatting to for a host of other reasons, to cause disruption at places, for political purposes, oftentimes even to divert law enforcement resources away from an actual crime that is actually occurring. And then finally, as you mentioned, as we've seen, you know, we've seen federal judges now who have been the target, including judges who are serving on various cases involving the former president. But it is a bipartisan issue. I've spoken with Republican lawmakers as well who were victims of this threat. One in particular who said that it was on Christmas Eve. He is away, but he gets a call from his neighbor saying there's this large police presence that has rolled up on his house. Someone had called in to 911 saying that he had killed his wife and was threatening to kill himself. And again, you can just imagine what that means as far as resources surging. So again, we have seen, sadly, an individual who was actually shot and killed by police. Police rolled up. They thought that this was a suspect. They gave him commands, and he didn't comply. So they thought that there might have been a threat there. Actually led to him being shot and killed. So a very, very serious threat that law enforcement is trying to wrap its arms around now, you know, as these threats continue.
So thanks for that overview, Josh. So can you, you know, putting on your former NYPD hat, can you walk us through what did these, you know, a lot of the coverage has focused on what it's like for the victim, in particular when we have more recently, we have elected officials. And again, bipartisan problem. There, you know, there have been both Democrats or Republicans at the elected leadership levels who have been targeted through this. But can you help us understand what does this look like on the law enforcement side from when the call comes in? And how is it different than, you know, I'm a child of the 1980s, like the old bomb threats where you get called in, people sort of know what the situation is, the location is cleared, and then everybody goes back in. What's different about this, these types of incidents when the call comes in on the law enforcement side?
So, you know, I think Josh touched on it, right? It's the advance of technology, it's the internet, and it's the virtual anonymity at which you're able to do these. And not just in your home community, right? These are being done on a national scale, sometimes an international scale. And I think that's one of the big things that's changed, you know, what you're talking about since the 80s. And listen, they still go on for a variety of reasons, right? There are still kids calling in bomb threats because they have a big test that day they didn't study for at their school, right? That's really not, I don't think, what we're focused on here. You know, but back then you couldn't even get into the 911 system in another city. You pick up the phone where you are, you call 911, you're connected to your local city's 911, right? So if you wanted to call in a bomb threat in another city, another county, another town, you weren't going to be able to really do that. Now you can. It also goes a step further in being able to spoof your location. So one of the first things that the officers are going to ask, they get that call, hey, there's an active shooter at a school, at a synagogue, a church, a mosque, a shopping mall. The first question they're going to ask the dispatcher is, where is this call coming from? Right. And if the dispatcher says, well, the call's coming from Los Angeles, California, and they're in New York, this is probably a hoax call. Right. But if the dispatcher is able to tell them, hey, that call's coming from inside the facility. Right. That's coming from a number assigned to the facility itself. That certainly now gives the call even greater credibility. And it's going to really ramp up the response. What does the response look like? It's certainly depending on the type of call and the nature of the call. But if it's an active shooter at a school, I can tell you this, every officer who's in earshot of that radio transmission is going and going fast, right? So you're not talking about a police car or two police cars, right? You're talking about dozens, maybe even more than that, right? And they're going as hard and fast as they can. Josh, you touch on the danger. Yeah, certainly there's a level of danger to the victims because they don't know what's going on when these officers roll up, and there have been tragic consequences in the past. But there's also danger to the officers and their response and to everyone else on the road at that point, right? So the officers legitimately believe that children are being shot in a school, and they're going to try as hard as they can to get there as fast as they can, which means that they're not driving safely, right? They're really going hard and fast, and there's always, you know, an increased risk now of traffic collisions and some of those with tragic consequences, trying to get to something that turns out to be a false alarm.
So I think part of what I'm hearing from you guys, so thanks for that. So I think part of what I'm hearing from you guys is what's different about it now has a lot to do with the technology through which the calls were able to come in. So that was an interesting point, Ken, about the fact that 911 calls used to be only localized And now based on the, I guess, communications infrastructure, the calls can come in from other locations. I guess that's also, so it's this tech, it really is this technology piece and the nature of communications, the ability to mask the origin of communications coming in. I've also read about the, you know, at CNAS, we have a huge line of work and body of work that's focused on AI as it relates to national security issues. To what extent are you guys aware of the use of AI or other tech, you know, newer technologies that are facilitating these threats? Josh, maybe I'll start with you.
Yeah, so AI is certainly one factor that law enforcement is grappling with. We've seen in many of these incidents that oftentimes the user, the person calling in the threat, will use some type of voice altering technology. And obviously with AI and voice, you know, being able to use someone else's voice, that poses all kinds of investigative challenges from previous years, where if you had a call coming into 911, you had the tape, you knew presumably what the number was, and so you can start working backwards. But now, just a lot of other challenges that law enforcement is now facing. There's also the fact when we're talking about the method that's typically used is voice over internet protocol. It's essentially, you know, all of us are familiar with, you know, dialing on online, you know, using many of the online services that are available. That poses a challenge because oftentimes the internet protocol address, the IP address, can be spoofed through multiple locations. And so for law enforcement to be able to actually go from point to point in order to actually get to the user is very difficult. As Ken mentioned, oftentimes these are coming from overseas, which presents a whole, you know, list of other challenges for law enforcement, both jurisdictional challenges as well as technological challenges. Just being able to actually determine what is the internet provider that's hosting this call and who is a subscriber. So a lot of challenges there. I will note, though, that law enforcement has begun to adapt to some of this technology, as difficult as all of this is. And certainly, as I talk to law enforcement leaders, this doesn't, reduce the need for some type of legislative action to try to, you know, increase criminal penalties. But for example, law enforcement is now trying to put together best practices for departments. So for example, with a lot of these voice over internet protocol services, you can't actually dial straight into 911. So a lot of these swatting calls are actually going into non-emergency numbers at various police departments, which is a big red flag, right, for law enforcement. If someone's really in the middle of an active shooter situation, why are you looking up and dialing the non-emergency line? So that's one aspect. And law enforcement is also now trained, as particularly dispatchers, to listen for particular characteristics, to include, you know, if the vocal intonation of the person isn't actually matching the threat that they're reporting, that's a big red flag. I've listened to a lot of these calls that have come in, and you know, you will have someone very subdued oftentimes just saying active shooter at this school, which, as you can imagine, if you're actually in a situation like that, you're probably gonna be a little more animated. So that's something to look out for. And then we can go on and on, but the final point I'll make as well is that law enforcement is now being trained to, you know, be on the lookout. Is this the only call that you've received about this potential threat? Because as we know, in the age of mass shootings, oftentimes if you have, you know, a mall shooting or a school shooting, law enforcement will be inundated with phone calls from various, you know, witnesses and people around the area. And so if you're basing your response over one specific call, that in and of itself could be a red flag. So a lot of technical challenges that the law enforcement is having to adapt to.
Mm-hmm. So can help us understand. So then how are these, Josh, you were talking about some of the mitigating factors that law enforcement is using to try to figure out the situation in real time. Let's jump ahead a little bit. And Ken, I want to ask you from the police department perspective, from the local law enforcement perspective. So then once the incident is actually resolved and it's determined that there was not actually a physical threat, but you had this huge law enforcement response that, you know, just based on needing to do their job, they had to implement. So now we've wasted the time of law enforcement. We have drained resources and diverted resources away from their regular duties and actual threats and public safety problems in the community. It seems to me that somebody should be held accountable for that. as well as terrifying the victims if they were, you know, home, if this was going to their home at the time. So Ken, what's the investigative process? Because my understanding is that this still really rests with the local law enforcement agency to conduct some type of investigation and potentially prosecute. So how does the investigation unravel?
Yep. So let's start for a second and just get a sense of what the current landscape in policing looks like across the country, right? Because police agencies are short-staffed. Mm-hmm. You know, big city police agencies, you know, are probably down 15% below their authorized headcount on average. Some of them are down more than 40%. Right. So it's a really desperate staffing situation for a lot of them. And so those resources are really scarce. And when you're pulling them, and again, you're not pulling a car, when you're pulling, you know, pretty much the entire working shift of a police department to an area for something that turns out to be a hoax, that's a problem. The investigative resources are similarly taxed, right? The detectives, because while homicides and shootings have declined over the past years in most cities, you know, across the country, they still remain above their pre-pandemic lows. And crime in general remains elevated in many of these cities, even if it's not gun violence, right? So how much can you afford to really dedicate to trying to investigate these types of crimes, knowing that in many places like New York, it's probably a misdemeanor? You may get it upgraded to a low-level felony if you can, you know, tack it on as a hate crime, or if you could add get a felony reckless endangerment tacked onto it. But otherwise, it qualifies as aggravated harassment under the law. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to prison for it. And with the wide range of other felonies that detectives have to investigate, can you really afford to dedicate those investigative resources? Because these are not quick cases. By and large, the callers are not calling from their own phone. Right. So you're not just going to track that phone number down, go knock on somebody's door. They're going to give you a confession. You're going to arrest them. Right. As Josh mentioned, they're going to be routed through, you know, VPNs, through multiple IP addresses. So now you're going in and you're subpoenaing a telephone provider for subscriber information. It's going to take you 30 days to get that information back. OK, that led you to another IP address. Now I have to drop another subpoena, maybe on another telecom, wait another 30 days to get that information back. And then if it takes me out of state, I am outside of my jurisdiction now, right? I have no authority to really continue to pursue this individual. And chances are the agency isn't going to want to really dedicate those resources to doing that. Now, there are exceptions to that. I know just earlier in February, there was a 17-year-old who was charged in Florida, extradited from California, and who they believe to be responsible for hundreds of SWATting incidents across the country. I think he's charged just with one or two incidents in Florida, but one of them was at a mosque and 30 police cars responded, you know, to this particular SWATting incident. And they are the local sheriff's department working with the FBI, actually put in the time and energy into this investigation. But that's the exception, you know, more than the rule.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Josh, putting your former FBI hat on and your reporting where you're, you know, I know you talk to federal law enforcement a great deal. How much can federal law enforcement help in this circumstance? You know, I mean, one of the things that I've been looking at is I've been looking at some of the laws that govern this. Ken mentioned at the state and local level, these are often misdemeanors at the state level. There is no specific federal law right now. There have been a couple legislative proposals in Congress, but there's actually no federal law governing this. So how are the federal law enforcement agencies, I'm thinking primarily of FBI, maybe HSI a little bit, you know, might have some interest in it. Do they have any hook that they can use to try to help state and locals with these investigative techniques, in particular in the circumstance that Ken's describing where, you know, local law enforcement, once it's out of their jurisdiction, they can't do anything. So we really need a federal angle to be able to help them out.
No, absolutely. And it's certainly an uphill battle. And that case that Ken mentioned is the perfect example. That's the model of cooperation between the local law enforcement, state law enforcement, and federal law enforcement. That teen who was arrested where I'm here in Southern California was arrested by this task force that was looking into all of these various incidents. Law enforcement described this as part of an online SWATting ring. So it wasn't just the teen, but a group of other people. And so now, you know, obviously law enforcement, if it's a one-off one-off situation. They have to determine, you know, what resources are we going to dedicate to this. But when you have multiple incidents involving multiple people, obviously, you know, law enforcement will want to dedicate resources to that. And so what happened, you have this team that's together. You had the feds, obviously, who were bringing their resources, particularly because a lot of these swatting victims were located in various states. So you have kind of the interstate hook there. But at the end of the day, as you mentioned, there's not a federal law against that. So that case was prosecuted, locally, essentially by the local DA, you know, to begin with. And so it's law enforcement being able to dedicate resources, which are precious, you know, as Ken mentioned, and then finding the proper venue to be able to do that. We have seen the FBI try to facilitate the sharing of information. And oftentimes, you know, when people hear about sharing information, you know, eyes kind of, you know, glaze over when you talk about law enforcement. But it is so critical here because, as you can imagine, these swatters are not just hitting one location. And so if you're a police department here in Los Angeles and you are, you know, you have a victim in your jurisdiction and there are similar characteristics to a swatting incident in Miami, you want to know that because oftentimes that will help link the same individual to multiple incidents. And to that end, what the FBI has done, they've created what they're describing as a virtual command center. It's essentially an online portal for police departments across the country to essentially upload characteristics about swatting incidents that they're seeing so that investigators can, and this isn't just the FBI doing this, this is collectively all of these agencies being able to see in real time the threat characteristics to say, you know what, we think this one might be linked to that one. And so let's work together. That doesn't make it any easier to try to investigate for all the reasons that Ken mentioned as far as technology. And then, you know, as we'll talk about the law as well, some of the challenges, but they're at least trying to do something. And that starts with coming together and at least having a venue in order to share information. But it is really difficult. I mean, there's not much good news that I hear from law enforcement about the nature of the threat. It is only growing. You know, these bad actors are seeing the results of their work, often in real time. You know, in some of these incidents recently involving the Jewish community where threats were being called in, it involved online services that were being streamed. And so these bad actors could see the real time result of their work. So it's really sinister stuff and certainly very, very challenging for police.
Ken, what on the law side, what would help from the perspective of local law enforcement? Would it be a federal law that then provides an additional mechanism through which federal law enforcement can come in and take over some of these investigations or provide more investigative resources and technical assistance to the state locals? Would it be greater penalties at the state level? I know in some states they are taking a look at their swatting specific laws at each individual state laws. But from your perspective, you know, on the local law enforcement side, what would be helpful to try to both bring individuals accountable, but also help bring down the number of incidents?
Yeah, so I really do think that you need a federal law, you know, with some appropriate penalties attached. You know, the question of more severe state and local laws, they're going to run the gamut across the country, obviously 50 states, you know, 50 different trains of thought there. But it's also the fact that oftentimes the bad actors are outside of that jurisdiction to begin with. So the state law isn't going to have the same amount of bite as a federal law does. The coordination center that Josh was referring to is really critically important because it does help guide where those scarce resources should go, right? Was this kind of a one-off incident or are we seeing dozens of similar? And this is kind of where we can make an impact on. But this is a problem that's not going to get better. As a matter of fact, anything technology is going to make it worse. And we've already seen some instances where, you know, with deepfake videos, where, you know, they are mimicking an active shooter situation in a shopping mall or in a school, and then uploading that video to social media, like, hey, this is happening right now. You know, I mean, a much more serious take on, I think a couple months ago in Miami, right? They were talking about aliens landing at the mall in Miami. But, you know, this video showing what appears to be a real live active shooter situation with crowd panic and everything else, and pushing that out, which is going to now spark a wave of 911 calls from locals who are seeing this on their social media feeds, who are very concerned about it. And obviously the big police response and absolutely nothing going on. So technology, as I said, is going to make this problem much worse before it gets better.
Josh, you mentioned the resource that FBI is putting together with their partners. On the law side, what are you hearing in your reporting on this issue from at both the state and local level? What are the law enforcement agencies think they need? Do they need a federal law?
Yeah, so twofold. We certainly hear police saying that look, the stiffer the penalties, obviously, the help serve as a deterrent. That is beneficial. Particularly, you know, there's one federal law that's been filed by Senator Rick Scott in Florida, which would essentially make the penalties up to 20 years in federal prison if someone's injured during the course of a swatting incident. And so I think, you know, seeing those prosecutions actually happen, if a law like that were to be on the books, you know, could serve as a deterrent. But the final point, and I constantly hear from law enforcement as well, and I think we do a pretty good job here at CNN, is, you know, a lot of these people do this for attention, right? They want the publicity. And so, you know, if all of you think back to last year, last summer, there was a wave of swatting incidents across the country involving schools, high schools, middle schools. Almost no one knew about it because a lot of, you know, very serious news organizations said, we're not going to publicize this. This is exactly what these people want. And so we try to be very circumspect about not, you know, talking about individual incidents to give them that gratification. But as you look at the volume of incidents, it's certainly, you can't turn away from that because police themselves are saying, look, this is an issue. We need the help. And I think we're going to see more legislative action take place to try to address those requests.
Yeah, I think that's right. It just seems to me, and we're down on our time now, so I'm going to thank Josh and Ken for joining us for this, but it seems to me that the status quo is unsustainable. It's unsustainable because we can't have everyday citizens, but in particular, individuals in public service. No one's going to want to serve if they constantly are worried that they and their families are going to be under threat from these kinds of incidents. And law enforcement has enough challenges on their plate. Ken described the difficulty in staffing police departments around the country right now anyway, without these added false reports. And so there needs to be additional legislative, from my perspective, additional legislative action to try to help out law enforcement on this and to bring some accountability for those who are perpetrating it. So Josh Campbell, Ken Corey, I want to thank you so much for lending your expertise and knowledge to this issue, and appreciate your time. Thanks to everybody who tuned in to join for this. And again, the archive of this video will be available on CNAS's website, and the audio will be put out on our CNAS Live podcast. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CNAS Live, a production of the Center for a New American Security. This episode was produced by Anna Peterson and Charles Horn, with design help from Melody Cook and Ren Rothback. Please rate and subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts.